Accession number 19767, Reel 4.
Quintophon Faskovsky, Reel 4.
One day I observed on the observation post a unit, probably it was an English unit, queuing up for their food. We could see a vehicle coming down and everybody got out and had their food, but we didn't fire on these people because yes, we thought it's not quite civilized. And secondly, we didn't have enough ammunition there. It was very, very Russian. And what happened to some of our battery, I don't know. They were completely demoralized. I met one or two people afterwards, and they never experienced such a bombardment. I was lucky. I was since, I think, January, I think 2nd January or 3rd January, I was posted to Groningen to train in they started making units out of people who had trouble with their stomach or with their legs or anything not full, fully trained or could be fully trained. And I was supposed to train these things. I was supposed in Groningen. And so the rest of the time I spent in Groningen up till the Canadians appeared there, and there was some fighting on the outskirts. They came in with flamethrowers, which frightens us. Terrible, terrible sight to see a flamethrower coming at you. And I think after about 3 or 4 days fighting, we surrendered.
What was the 3 or 4 days fighting like?
Delaying, no, probably not 3, 4, perhaps 1 or 2, before the Canadians came very methodical. They took one street after the other, shot us as we retreated, and in the end of it, it was a center, which was taken by the Canadians quite easy because there was no resistance really. I don't think I did see too much of my unit because they were divided up into parts. There's one street and the other street. We were not really trained for street fighting.
You mean these men were semi-invalids?
Yes. They had special food.
And you were in charge of them?
There was somebody else there. I was helping to train them there. They had their proper structure, officer structure there. I was sort of consultant or whatever you call it, just to help out.
What rank did you have by then?
Lieutenant still.
How did the Canadians treat you who captured you?
First thing they took from us was their watches. Otherwise very fair. That was later in the prisoner of war camp was a sort of standing joke. Oh, we ought to be watchmakers, go to Canada because they're all our watches. No, it was otherwise. Some of these watches, of course, were Wehrmacht or army watches. And that is army property would have been quite legally gone over to whoever takes over.
Were these watches any good?
No, nothing special. They were quite good watches, yes, but I mean, Switzerland at that time supplied watches to the Germans and the English. So
what happened to you once you were captured?
Prisoner of war camp. First we were in, it was somewhere near, in Holland somewhere. I think we had two or three camps. The first camp was very good. English troops, English commandant. Then the second camp was a bit funny. There was an English commandant, but Belgian youngsters, more or less. And I think I was in hospital for some reason. I can't remember what it was. And one of these Belgian chaps knew from my uniform, lieutenant, and he came, waving his gun and almost trying to shoot me. And so some of our chaps went out, and there was then some English military personnel there, and they got him out quite quickly. But of course, after the war, you can't help it. It's passion is aroused. I don't know what happened to his parents or his home. But
where was that?
In Belgium somewhere. Can't remember where. And then most of the time we spent near Ostend in a place called Jabbeke, which is, there is from Ostend now a very straight road down to, I believe, Brussels, and Jabbeke is very close by there. I spent a year there. It was an officers' camp, so we were not allowed to work, we were not allowed to... we would have done all sorts of things, but not allowed. But otherwise, treatment was quite fair. And I came out in 46, in March, I believe. I got my paper still here.
You were released
from
the camp?
From prisoner of war camp, yes. Shipped back to Germany. Of course, then the big question was, the first, I had to stay somewhere. I knew that Königsberg was called Kaliningrad now. And was Russian territory. I didn't know what happened to my father. I didn't know what happened to my mother or my brother. So I thought I have to go down to stay somewhere, released. And then the commandant from the ex-commandant from Groningen, he was ex-Air Force major. He was made commandant of it. He said, well, come with me. You can stay in my home. And he was in Rhineland somewhere. München, Gladbach? No, München. Can't remember now. I did visit him later on. He was a very nice chap. Because he knew from Groningen, I was... attached to his staff and sort of adjutant, and therefore he said, well, if you don't know where to go, come to me. So I went to his place and nearly started. He had a factory producing packing material, and I nearly started or intended to start it there, learning the trade, because normally, except for my A-levels, which we didn't take, I didn't learn anything except for the army stuff. And then a letter arrived from my aunt, which was then the East Germany, that my mother was also in East Germany, but not in the place she lived, in the place near Magdeburg. So obviously I thought, well, I have to see my mother. And then I left this place, and whatever I had, I really didn't have anything except my boots, my coat, and nothing else. I don't know how I think I borrowed some money, or they gave it to me from some of the old, from our unit, which used to be in France. There the captain was still there. I saw him. He's still alive. We still are writing Christmas cards. And his daughter came over here. And there were several other people who gave me some money too, so that I could go over to the east, because I didn't have any money. So I crossed over to the east. That was another long, long story. But then I met my mother. My mother fled with a little mini trunk, I would say. She thought she would be back and about in Königsberg within a week or fortnight, but that of course didn't happen. She didn't have even her bank accounts or anything with it, so, and she was evacuated in eastern Germany near Magdeburg, a little village. And so I turned there up in 1946, and I had to do something for her. So the best thing I could do at that time was go into the building trade. And I started to work as a bricklayer. Got one firm in Salzwedel there, which was a place where my mother was, or close by, and started my training, and even passed my first examination as a bricklayer after about 1.5 or 2 years. And then really I had some ideas to go to university to get into the architect profession. And I thought this is easy because I have some practical experience. And at that time, too many people wanted to go to university, would accept it, or would easier be accepted if you had some practical experience. So I applied to the Technical University in Karlsruhe, and on account of my bricklayer title or examination, was accepted straight away for the next year. And to finance my first year in West Germany, I smuggled 6 bottles of vodka from East to West Germany and left it in Karlsruhe with an old friend of mine with whom I was together in Russia and at school, and told him, well, if I come over and sell, I had a bank account there, if I tell you, sell the vodka, put the money into the account, and then I can live out for a year. But then the Währungsreform set in Germany. Everything was, in West Germany, everything was reduced. I think everybody started with 60 mark on his as cash. Any bank account of people not living in there, were eradicated, really. So my bank account there was Nordpont-Nord. And so that didn't work. And by that time, I met my wife, who was the daughter of a watch and clockmaker. And you had a shop in the village there.
Which village?
Dere, that is by Salzwedel, a very small village. That is, but still in the eastern part of Germany. And so after some fruitless attempts to go to university, because originally I wanted to study law. I was matriculated in Königsberg already, but of course that was all gone. And in the East Germany then, my name, von, didn't fit into the worker and farmers society. My school didn't fit in. So normally I wouldn't have a chance to go to university there, except one place in my old school teacher. He was a professor on the university in Greifswald. He said, well, I try it. But anyhow, it didn't work out. So I thought, well, okay, I start again and take up watchmaking. So my father-in-law taught me the first facts of watchmaking. And there again, I passed after 2 years, I passed the examination. And there was my father's shop, my father-in-law's shop, and his brother's shop, which was a larger town. I worked there, and we were supposed to take over that shop, but after the brown dictatorship, I really didn't feel I could survive in a red dictatorship. And I married my wife, and I didn't feel that I want my children growing up in the eastern zone. So we had ideas of fleeing, and I fled from East Germany in 1952, so that is about 6 years after I came out of the prisoner of war camp.
What was life like in East Germany in those years?
Limited. You had one thing. You had potatoes. You had reasonable food, but you had no liberty. You had no freedom. The communists tried to rule everything. The private farmers were they had to go into kolkhozes. So that does mean
collective farming.
Collective farming, yes. You had it was a typical dictatorship, and even there were some other parties there, but they were really non-existent. And at that time, of course, thousands of Germans left East Germany. And I got out. We had quite an ingenious plan to leave East Germany via West Berlin, and that worked all right. So at least I got my tools out, nothing else. And my wife joined me there, and we landed in 1952 in West Berlin.
How did you escape?
Well, at that time there was no wall. The wall was built in 55, I think, or 56. No wall, but there was police control. You had to open your bags and so on. But as I said, I had a very good story to get through there, and I had a friend in West Berlin where I could leave my tools, and so I got through all right.
What story did you give them?
Well, to go, I saw I believe it was a newspaper, that some watchmaker in Nauen was looking for a watchmaker. So I wrote to him, And he said, yes, fine, come and see me. But to get to Nauen, you had to leave, you had to go through East Germany, go into East Berlin, cross from East Berlin to West Berlin, and go from West Berlin again into East Territory. So there is no other way, there was no direct connection, train connection. So what I did now is I pretended to take this post in Nauen, and on my way to Nauen, I left my tools in West Berlin with a friend of mine who said, who came later to see me here in England. And so each time I went to Nauen, I even declared my presence there to the police. You had to, if you stay one night there, you had to tell the police where you are staying. We found a little hotel there, or bed and breakfast place where we stayed. And so I went, and my wife went there several times, up till we had all our tools and bits which we could get out in West Berlin. Because we could quite legally go through from East Germany into East Berlin, but then as soon we left East Berlin, we were stopped by police. Where are you going? Blah, blah, blah. Had to open our luggage. And then, of course, I always could show that I want to go to this place in Nauen, which I only could reach by passing through West German territory. And it worked in the end. I had a lot of private things there, or family things there. And I know one of the guards, he stopped it and he said, well, what do you need this for, your new job? This is all private things. They were very suspicious of any fleeing people there, because there are hundreds every day fled East Germany. And I was short of an answer, really, I must say. I didn't work that out beforehand. But at that moment, he was called by one of his other guards. They had found it, to their eyes, suspicious character there. So he went away and he said, stay here. But I disappeared, and so I got through all right to West Berlin. And there we had to go to a camp. I think we stayed there for 3 weeks nearly, because we had to go through all sort of examinations, and they want, because there was a lot of influx of certain men here, spies were left, right, and center. And then we were flown out to West Germany by plane, because we did the train thing, was there was an airlift to Berlin that was before. Train was rather risky. We were flown out and we landed with a sister of my wife in Hamburg.
What and was West Germany like after East Germany?
Paradise, almost, at that time. They had already 6 years of constant currency. After East Germany, and for mainly freedom, I mean, you had, you could read papers in East Germany. You couldn't read a paper. They all said the same. There was no divergence. And I think if you once go through a dictatorship and you see afterwards that if there is no free press under Hitler, this is where Hitler succeeded, because there was no press. We never heard what happened in the other countries, except what was in your paper, what you could see. And now my father, at that time, we had a little radio there, and he always tried to listen to the Russian radio. They had some German news, but the rest of it was limited, very limited. So West Germany was like a glimmer of hope. But my mother did die in the meantime. My brother, I was missing. I don't know what happened to him. And I knew that my father was killed last day before Königsberg was taken by the Russians, so I was left on my own. And I always had some ideas, oh, I go to Canada, not because of what we heard about the Rogers, but in general, I liked the idea of going to Canada. And but my wife, she thought it's too far away, her mother was still alive. She thought, no, it's too far. And one day, I was working in Hamburg. One day in Hamburg, I went to the labor exchange and somebody said, do you want a job in England? And I thought, well, I try it. If I don't like it, I go back again. And that was in 1953. And it was a job in North Devon, in Biddeford. And I loved it. I really loved it. I really loved it, so I stayed. And my wife followed me in a few months later.
How were you accepted by English people?
Very, very well. They treated me very well indeed. I had difficulties with language in the beginning. I never had at school any English. We had French and Latin and Greek, but no English. So I slept with a dictionary under my pillow for months. And I found my landlady was a Scottish lady. I could understand their hard English much better than some of the North Devon dialect, really. But in general, no, there was no, and I had very soon English friends, or we had English friends. And one of my friends, we started a business later on. So.
In watchmaking,
yeah.
Do you have English nationality now, or German?
No, still German. I thought one of these days, I'm a big European. I mean, with my background, is Polish ancestors in one line, a German background, and now in England, I was always a great believer in the European idea, and I thought, well, one day we may not need it, and so I didn't bother to apply for citizenship.